From the studios of the Living on Earth Network in Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth Today. Welcome to Living on Earth Today. I'm Susan Shepherd. In September of 1994, Living on Earth aired the following newscast item.
The CIA says efforts by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to rid his country of rebels has created an environmental disaster in Iraq's southern marshlands. An agency report says Hussein ordered almost 2,000 square miles of wetlands drained so that Iraqi troops and tanks could pursue insurgents hiding out there. The report says Iraq used a dam and a canal to divert waters from the Tigris River and turned once rich marshlands into desert, driving almost 100,000 rebels across the border into Iran. Baghdad claims it was trying to create farmland in the region.
In 1991, in the wake of the first Gulf War, the government of Iraq began systematically draining the marshes in what the United Nations called one of the world's greatest environmental disasters. As you watch the news reports from the war front, you see the results of that effort on your TV. Pictures of the dry, dusty Iraqi landscape as the U.S. and U.K. war machines moves on Baghdad. Not so long ago, some of that desert you're looking at was part of a lush Mesopotamian marshland. The region, which is considered by some to be the site of the original Garden of Eden, supported people and wildlife for thousands of years. Lions used to roam there. Orange County, California resident Ramadan Albadron grew up in those marshlands and recognized one dried-out roadway north of Nazaria from the newscasts.
This highway, the troops was moving on it. It used to be surround both sides with a fence of green, fresh reeds and water. The reed was up to 10, 15 feet, and this reed goes all the way to the end of like 100 kilometers apart, full and packed with all this type of life of fish and animals and birds. So today we have seen only an old highway with a dirt area like anywhere in the desert.
Less than 10% of the original marshland is left, and what remains is clustered on the Iraq-Iran border. But some people haven't given up hope for these destroyed wetlands. Husband and wife Azam and Susie Awash are spearheading a restoration project for the Mesopotamian marshes they call Eden Again. Azam is a civil engineer, Susie is a geologist, and they talk to Steve Kerwood from Los Angeles.
Those people, actually, root-wise, we consider them as Arabian. But in fact, those people, they have the heritage of all the civilization, like a Sumerian, and also because still we have a lot of habits and a lot of cultures linked directly to the Sumerian civilization. They have two mainly jobs. Some of them they count on the agriculture side, and some of them they count by grown animals. Those they grow agriculture, they spend hundreds of years, generations after generation, collect the mud from the bottom of the marsh and then put it on top of each other until they create a land for farming. And they keep maintain this farming seasonally to keep adding new soil to add more fertility to it. And as well, they do secondary fishing, which is they live in an area surrounded with water and environment for fishing. As well, they do a lot of secondary job, like they fabric the nuts or something else. As well, the other type of human living there, those people, they grow the water buffalo mainly. And beside this, they go fishing and do selling the milk and all this product. And in the same time, you're going to see a very natural area, large area of water, lakes, as well some rivers in between. Reeds, you surround with green area to the infinite. You surround with the quiet, super quiet area. You cannot hear nothing industrial beside those bird or some fish. They jump from the water, or maybe some fisherman, he put some radio next to it to enjoy those country music while he is sitting there throwing his net and fishing.
This place, in its original glory, sounds like the Garden of Eden.
Well, it's very easy to call Garden of Eden, because when you go there, you really, you feel you are missing nothing and you have everything. I remember we used to sleep on the roof of the house, which is all built from reed on canes. And I remember during the night, those pigs, they come to eat some of the farm. And they have a mess with the vegetables. And I used to be young, and I get upset. We should shoot them. We should hurt them. They cannot eat those vegetables. My uncle always, he answered me, he said, no, you cannot. This is their share in this environment. So this type of peaceful people and honest people and giving people, it's really hard to see them today. They live in the cities. I feel the shame that this life could survive those thousands of years and then end up in my generation to disappear.
Azam, let me turn to you. When did the ecology of this region begin to change in this century, and what was the role of governments in that?
The marshes of southern Iraq, which are larger than the Everglades, have historically been used by people who wanted to be away from the control of the central government. It's a place where people went to hide from the central government authority. Following the 1991 Gulf War, the people of the south of Iraq went into rebellion. And when the rebellion was crushed by the Iraqi army, the natural area of refuge would be in the marshes. The regime of Saddam Hussein could not let these rebels be alone, especially since the rebels used to come out at night and harass the security apparatus. So he set about specifically depriving the marshes of water. As you have heard Ramadan talk about the fact that the water is the source of life in the marshes, and the reed beds are in fact what makes life of the marsh dwellers work. In fact, they use the reed beds to build their houses out of it. They use it to build their islands out of it. They use it to feed their water buffalo. They use it to for fuel. Everything that they do is involved with the reeds. And if you deprive the area of water, the reed beds die, and therefore their way of life stops.
So how were the marshes drained, Azam?
The marshes were systematically drained in 1991 by building several rivers or canals that were designed to divert the water away from the marshes. From the Euphrates around the southern edges of the marshes, there were three major rivers. One of them is Mother of Battles River. The next is Loyalty to the Leader Canal, and then Saddam's River. These rivers direct the water from the Euphrates around the marshes into the Gulf directly. And there is also the Glory River, which intercepts water that comes from the Tigris into the central marsh area, diverts it into Shatt al-Arab and away from the central marsh. I need to impress your listeners of the feat that was accomplished. To dry an area larger than the Everglades in a period of 5 years is an incredible human engineering feat. It's destructive. It is an instance of using water as a weapon of mass destruction, because, in fact, what happened as a result of this act is a culture that has lasted for 5,000 years ceased to exist. The marsh dwellers, which numbered around 300,000 people, no longer can live in the marshes. They, in fact, 70,000 of them ended up in the Iranian refugee camps, and the rest were internally dispersed, and about 30,000 ended up in refugees all around the globe.
This marsh area, what does this area look like now?
Desert. It is desert. In fact, in some areas of the marshes, it is in fact encrusted with about 2 feet of salt. As a result of as the water dried out, it kind of got into smaller and smaller pools. And when the water left, it left the salts behind. It is nothing but desert and salt. It's a shame.
And how many people live there?
You cannot live inside the marshes. That way of life ceased to exist because, in fact, there is no water. And as a result of this, in fact, there's no water. The reed beds have been dried out and, in fact, burned, specifically burned by the regime of Saddam Hussein. The birds that used to fly from Siberia to northern Africa and stop in the marshes as a respite no longer can do that, except possibly in Huweza. And Huweza, is rather sickly because Iran has built a dam on the river that feeds the Huweza marsh and now is releasing some water as the reservoir has been filled. But it's not as vibrant as it used to be.
How much of the original marshland is left today?
About 10%. Right between the Iraq-Iran border, the Huweza Marsh, the northerly part of Huweza Marsh.
Susie, tell me about the genesis of the Eden Again project, if you would. You and your husband Azam live in California. How'd you get things started out there?
Well, I'm the one of the three that's never been to the marshes at all. I just looked at it in books when I first met Azam and fell in love with this area, and it was one of the places we always wanted to go. When we read the United Nations report in August 2001, it hit us like a kick in the stomach. We had heard of draining, but it wasn't until we actually saw the satellite images of vibrant vegetation, extensive water going down to literally just desert. And we said, someone must do something about this. The United Nations said, you know, everyone must do something about this, and nobody was doing anything about it. And we, being engineers and scientists, we took the approach of, you know, let's not sit on our hands, let's not think about who's to blame for it, but let's think, if you could get rid of those diversion structures, if you could put water back in that, how would you go about it? And we decided to get together a group of internationally renowned experts, and we call them our technical advisory panel, but they're really the guardian angels of the marshlands. I mean, I'm not a wetlands expert ourselves, but we just got at the list of the National Research Council Committee on Wetlands, and I started calling them up, asking them if they would come to a workshop unpaid for this highly controversial issue. I couldn't get anyone to say no.
This is amazing. You're calling these people up, people you've never met, you're not an expert in the field, and they don't say no. They all show up. What happens then?
We held our workshop last month in February for 2 days. We gave them the premise. If the government of Iraq wanted to restore the wetlands, how would they go about it? And they were all just absolutely wonderful. Instead of saying, well, scratching our heads, you have to research it for decades first, they said, well, no, here's a list of some very specific data needs that you need immediately before you should put water back. And here are some very immediate actions, things like just getting rid of ordinance and looking for toxic substances, because poisons have been introduced into the marshes and the rivers have been used as open sewers.
What do you see as the first steps?
Their basic conclusion was you shouldn't put an uncontrolled release of the water back to the marshlands, but you should very quickly and early on start putting water back in certain areas and seeing how the soil reacts to rehydration. How the plants will react. Will they spontaneously come back, or will they need to be planted? Are there refugia where the animals are that can come back into the marshlands? The Eden Again Project will not be restoring the wetlands. The people of Iraq, the local people, have to develop the actual project and own the restoration themselves. But we are acting as the promoters of that and trying to gather together the resources that they will need to do that.
So what kinds of scientists and people did you get involved in this?
Mainly restoration ecologists, but we tried to get a mix of people who were just simply a outstanding international and expertise, but also people who have local knowledge. And we also aimed for some geographical distribution. So a lot from the United States, from Canada, from Switzerland, from Greece. We have geographers and biologists and chemists and civil engineers and just a very multidisciplinary. We're looking to try to get the whole field of people.
Even humanitarian organizations were included, those that were taking care of the refugees, in order to get their input as to what the people of the marshes would want to see happen.
Ecology doesn't usually respect political boundaries, and in this case, the marshes of Mesopotamia originally were mostly in the area that we call Iraq today, but also includes part of Iran. What have you been able to involve with people from those governments?
We have three Iranian ecologists working on the project with us also. And we have someone from the Kuwait also, because there's impacts downstream also.
Azam, tell me, what effect might this war in Iraq have on the bits of remaining marshland, that which is still there? I mean, how endangered do you think they are by the current military activities?
I am scared, Steve. I was hoping that none of the oil wells which exist on the fringes of the marshes would be bombed and allowed to spew their oil on what remains of the southerly portion of Hammar Marsh. Fortunately, only nine wells have been, at least we're told only nine wells have been destroyed, so the amount of damage is not as extensive as it could have been. Still, the war is not over. There could potentially be the use of chemicals or biological weapons. Who knows? The impact, of course, is going to be on the civilians a lot more than on the environment. But also, if the oil stays there, this could potentially make the soil in the southern part barren, and it might kill whatever seed beds that we may have left embedded in the soil.
Right now, there are a lot of American troops in what used to be this marsh area. What impact will that military activity have on the marsh or the former marshland?
I think that most of the it's unclear exactly where they are, but I think that most of the units went around Nasiriyah and have skirted around to the west of the marshlands. And I'm very happy to see that most of the fires are going to be out very soon from the oil fields. We were very worried about that and very pleased to see that those were secured very rapidly.
The United Nations Environment Program is now drawing attention to the dire situation of the Mesopotamian marshlands and talking about pulling together a regional response to this situation. What's the next step in translating all these plans and discussions into actions?
That's a very good question. We have been kind of scrambling together to try to figure that one out. The next step is to try to get some of the scientists on the ground when it's as soon as it's safe, and to try to convince the forces that are there and the humanitarian aids that are there to try to prioritize this area for creating safe zones for scientists to work in. And in addition to getting the scientists on the ground to do some of the early technical work, it's very important to start gathering together a stakeholder group of the local Iraqis and Iranians and Kuwaitis and the local scientists and the other government officials and the other stakeholders to try to begin to come up with a vision for what the marshland should be. What do they want, and what shape should it take to fulfill their goals and wishes?
Azam, tell me, why do you think that this project of rehabilitating the marshes is drawing so much international interest and support?
The marshes are the symbol of Western civilization. That's the cradle of Western civilization around the marshes. Their destruction is, in fact, potentially cutting off the roots of the Western civilization. Even as a symbol, restoring the marshes as a symbol to the Iraqi people, in fact, will give them this hope that, in fact, life in the day after Saddam is, in fact, better, in the sense that if we bring this thing back to life, it's a symbol for the entire nation. We can bring it back from death and from destruction and build it again and restore it to the way it was.
How important to the economy of this region are these marshlands if they could be restored?
There is a direct impact on the fisheries. We know that the fisheries in the Gulf have suffered a lot as a result of the loss of the spawning area. The marshes used to be the area where the fish would swim up and spawn. The shrimperies, in fact, have suffered a lot. The fact that the water is being dumped directly into the Gulf with all the silt that it carries, that it used to dump inside the marshes before it gets into the Gulf, that has also caused a lot of problems. So just the impact on the fisheries is enough of an incentive for the Gulf countries to help in restoring the marshes, because, in fact, they will get a direct benefit, although they are far, far away from the marshes.
But there's more, I take it.
There is more. There is also the fact that you could restore rice plantation around the perimeter, fisheries inside the marshes themselves. There is also the potential for ecotourism, mat weaving. There is all sorts of activities that have ceased to exist that could go back and provide the people of the marshes and also the area around the marshes of a way of earning a living instead of being dependent on the government as they are right now.
Susie, how long do you think restoration would take, and what are the chances that there could be a complete return to what was there before in terms of its ecology and biological diversity?
A return to its complete diversity could take you back 5,000 years before humans started disturbing the area. And there, the ancient Assyrian descriptions show lions in the area. I think that we could get back to where the 70s were, back to the 1960s, probably within a matter of years. And we hope that early on that we can, with as soon as it's safe to have scientists back in there, as soon as it's safe to do some work, as soon as we're sure that release of water won't further damage the environment, in fact, that certain areas can be have water put back to them. We're hoping to see rejuvenation of the Huesa Marsh within the first year. That's an area that only has recently desiccated. It needs some water back immediately to sustain the animal life there as a propagule for species for the other areas of the marshes. Some of the other areas need demonstration projects immediately while studies are going on for how best to restore them and while the country is deciding what shape they want the marsh to take. There's not 100% of the water available that used to be available, number one. Number two, these are the most highly disturbed natural areas in the world. 5,000 years of humans have changed this area, and so restoration to what is essentially a more enormous question here than elsewhere in the world.
Turkey controls a fair amount of the water in the Euphrates. They've been damming it up. What cooperation is necessary from Turkey to help restore this area?
The initial steps can happen without even Turkish cooperation. However, the long-term cooperation of Turkey is, in fact, needed. But, of course, that is something up to the future government of Iraq to deal with and the government of Turkey. There are ideas that could be exploited in order to bypass the political friction by buying electricity from Turkey. And that will force Turkey to release water, and it will give them also direct benefit from the regime change. There are many, many outside-the-box solutions that can be exploited for the purpose of generating more water to affect the restoration of the marshes. But obviously, everything that is needed to be done requires political will in Baghdad. If there is political will in Baghdad to affect rejuvenation or restoration, then it will be possible.
Ramadan, let me turn back to you now. You spent a great deal of time in the marshes. How easy do you think it'll be for all those people who were forced to flee the dried-out marshes to return to the area and resume their earlier lives if the water comes back?
They will come back very soon as the environment continues coming back. And beside those people, a lot of other people, they interest to take advantage of the marshland as a way of living. The whole entire region will take advantage of the restoration of the marshland. So many multi-reason forced to get this thing back.
Ramadan Al-Badran grew up in the marsh region of southern Iraq. Susie Alwash is director of Eden Again, and Azam Alwash is senior project advisor. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve, thanks you. Thank you for putting the spotlight on the marshes. Your audience is very much needed for the next stage.
You can hear Living on Earth on National Public Radio and the World Radio Network. To find a member station near you, go to www.loe.org or www.npr.org. This is Living on Earth Today.